The one thing that really stands out when I look at Full Force is the lovers as brothers, as a family, and that is very unique, especially in an industry where it can really test you and stuff. So that's why I thought I'd focus on that, and I think from that it will probably sort of be the benchmark for all the other things you've done. But you know, I guess I wanted to always start from the beginning. Is it just three brothers with your parents? Was that the family?
Well, Full Force, you know, six members, right?
Six members, but that's yes.
So, but it started with us. I mean, the cousins, they were doing their thing too, but we as Full Force started with me and my two brothers, Paul Anthony and B Fine. So the three of us, I think B made a song called "If You Can Want." And my father heard him singing that, and he's like, "Oh my God!" He went to my mom, honey, he can sing, because my father is from St. Thomas, Virgin Islands. So,
okay,
he was always singing in doo-wop groups himself. You know what I mean? So Paul started singing. My father started working with him. I got jealous, so I wanted to sing also. Dad, I want to sing too. So he started working with me as well, me and my brother Paul. Now my brother B-Fine, he was forced into it because he didn't really want to sing. But my father forced him. He said, you're going to sing or you do nothing else. You know, he would like spank him. not like really, you know, but he would definitely spank him. And then he started singing with me and my brother, and we sang as a trio. And then my uncle Cito put us together as a group. He said, why don't they be a group? He bought us these flashy little shirts with collars on them. And then we became a group and we called ourselves the Amplifiers.
Okay.
And we were performing just the three of us, like in local places. And, you know, my father would always teach us the harmonies. But the big thing for us came when, because we were raised in Brooklyn. I was born at St. Thomas, Virgin Islands, but we were still raised in Brooklyn. But the big thing came when my uncle got us to perform at the Apollo Theater, the amateur hour. At, you know, with the Apollo Theater is the amateur hour every Wednesday, every week. And you had to win 4 weeks in a row, and then you appear on the professional show. And that's what we did. And my father joined with my uncle. We came in first. We tied for first place the first time. Then we came in third place. But then when my father took over, we won first place every week, 4 weeks in a row. And we got to appear on the professional show with a legend R&B singer by the name of Joe Tex. I don't know if you ever heard of him, but he's a legend. Joe Tex. And then the Whispers. The Whispers is an R&B group, their first time performing at the Apollo. And the rest was history. We got to appear on a professional show. We kept bothering the Whispers at their dressing room as little kids. And when we grew up to be Full Force, we told them about the little bratty kids that used to bother them in their dressing room. Like, those were you? That was you guys? I said, yeah. So, yeah, man. So,
but what was the, was your dad inspired by the Jacksons, or what was his thoughts when he tried to?
At that time, the Jacksons wasn't even out. You know, we're about the same age as the Jacksons, kind of. So they weren't even out then. You know, he was just putting us together because he comes from the era of like Frankie. My uncle took us to see the Jacksons because the Jacksons performed at the Apollo. They didn't have a record out at the time, but there was that big of a local group from Gary, Indiana, that they would put on those professional shows. You know, he kept saying, man, you got to see the Jackson 5. And they performed at the Apollo on the professional show. That's how great they were, you know, before a record deal.
Wow.
So my father just wanted, you know, he just knew his love for singing. He just wanted us to have the love of singing as well.
Yeah. But as I said, but was it any thought about being a professional career after this? Or was it just a nice pastime to keep you guys out of trouble?
No, he wanted a professional career. That's why we performed at the Apollo Theater. Because we used to sing on the street, do wops for money, and we performed. We did steps and everything, the three of us. And by going to the Apollo Theater, yeah, and then on a professional show, he wanted us to excel in that. My uncle, too. which eventually we did, you know, not as a group initially as producers after a while. But that was the thing, man. When we did the Apollo, we thought we made it. We're like, wow, we made it. Because the professional shows each week, you had Stevie Wonder 1 week.
Yeah.
And then you had the Temptations the other week. And I'm like, man, it was crazy, you know?
Yeah, but because you know, I guess it's, you know, for I'm based in the UK, but and I guess it's, well, we do watch the Apollo, you know, Sandman coming in when people booing and stuff. But was there clear power? And I know the industry was quite different back then. You had a lot of small independents, so it's not like now where you just got the big three. But was there path? We get you on the Apollo, an A&R person would spot you and sign you. Was that the idea, or was it just, let's just hope for the best?
Yeah, we'll hope for the best. And the thing about it is that even after the Apollo, it wasn't like we got a record deal or nothing, but we were so young, but we just stayed grinding and performing in the neighborhood. And we perform in all four boroughs or five boroughs or whatever, from Bronx, Queens, Long Island, Brooklyn. And we just still performed. And then a turning point for us was when we moved to another spot in Brooklyn, and the three brothers got together with the three cousins, who was Baby Jerry, Shy Shy, and Kurt. And once we got together, that's when we became Full Force. And we started performing as a local band and a self-contained band and group. And we were pretty damn good. We just couldn't get a record deal because we were trying with cassette tapes and stuff like that, handing them to record companies. Sometimes we'd sneak out there. You know, I'll never forget one time. That's how we went to the studio. Me and my brother, it was so crazy. Me and Paul, we went to the studio, Power Station Studio, because we wanted, you know, we wanted to meet Nile Rodgers. You know, Nile Rodgers, so chic. And yeah. Nile Rodgers was there. And I remember it was him and Bernard. What was Bernard's last name? But anyway, Bernard Edwards, because they were chic.
Yeah.
And there they were, with Nile Rodgers standing court, and me and my brothers like near the piano. I don't know how we even got in there, but there they were, like, not arguing, but Nile Rodgers saying to the girls, to Sister Sledge, "I refuse to work with any artist that has an attitude." And blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, wow, I can't believe we're part of this, listening to this. And we're unknowns. But he was giving like a little tongue lashing to Sister Sledge. You know, before recording them. But we knew that was like the first guy that, yo, man, if we can get Nile Rodgers' attention. And we got his attention all right, but we didn't get no record deal. We were like nuisances. But after that, our co-manager at the time, Steve Salem, he said, "Guys, listen, we keep handing in demos and recordings to these record companies and they're just not biting. I feel in my heart, if you guys produce and write music for others, then I think you guys could get a record deal as Full Force yourselves as artists." And I never understood that, because I'm like, I've never heard of an R&B group producing anybody back then. Like, who does that? But I got voted out because I didn't really care about writing and producing for other people. I just wanted to just concentrate on Full Force. But the group went for it, you know, majority ruled. And thank God, because that's been our bread and butter for our career, writing and producing for others.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, you know, getting to that. It's, you know, I've interviewed close to 50 artists over the past year, and the stories about the business and the industry and things like that. But going back into those early days, I think the one thing we note about when Full Force came out, you had a certain image, that a style that you had. When you were trying to get the record deals, what was the image and style that you were going to the labels that they saw?
Well, yeah, our image was kind of, we dressed like rockers, but we had a hip hop attitude and an R&B sensibility. But the way we looked with our jerry curls, we looked like rockers, crazy rockers. And then we had the torn, ripped up shirts showing our physiques, because at that time was no group showing their physiques or talking about physical fitness. Nobody, but we did. And it was crazy. So that was our style back then. And even when we finally got a record deal for Full Force, our style was crazy, but our original songs we thought was great as well, you know. But
did they say why they turned you down? Did you get a nice sense of why they weren't warming to you? Is it the image or the songs that they didn't like at the time? What was your on reflection? What do you think the labels didn't like?
I don't know. It could have been songs, maybe, because we were singing some crazy songs, but we don't know why. But we do know that once we produced two acts, all of a sudden, we was like in a bidding war for two record companies to sign Full Force. It was crazy. But because we were producers, like the first artist that we ever worked with and that had records out, and we didn't even produce them, but we kind of produced them, but we never got that credit. But it was okay because he treated us like we weren't scrubs. And that was Curtis Blow, the king of rap. Yeah. We did five songs with Curtis Blow on two different albums. That's because our co-producers, Robert Ford and J.B. Moore, gave us that shot. And we wrote a song called Under Fire. We even wrote the lyrics and he did it. And he was an ego or nothing. He treated us with so much respect. So the biggest Curtis Blow song we was ever a part of was a song called Basketball. They're playing basketball.
Yeah, that was huge. I was in Nigeria. And I was in Africa back then.
Well, they played it out there too in Nigeria?
Yeah. Back I was in high school and that was a big, big track. Basketball was my favorite sport. I liked the way, yeah. You guys wrote it? Co-wrote it with him?
We co-wrote that and we played on it. You know? Wow. Yeah, that's before we were even known. And then after that, we got three guys together by the name of UTFO and the breakout song. So with UTFO, Kango Kid, Dr. Ice, the educated rapper, may he rest in peace, and Mixmaster Ice, the DJ, we created a huge song, which was called Roxanne, Roxanne, which was my brother B-Fine's concept. And it was just like a throwaway record, like a B-side, because the A-side was a song called Hanging Out. At least we thought it was the A-side. and then my brother B-Fine just woke up one day and he said, yo, man, I want to do a B-side record. You know, I'm going to call it Roxanne, Roxanne, Roxanne. And he told the guys, and I want you guys to rap about a girl. You're trying to get a girl, but none of y'all get her. This girl you don't get. And we did it. We produced it, Roxanne, Roxanne. And it was a huge hip-hop hit. It was a huge hip-hop hit. Did you guys get that in Nigeria?
Yeah. I mean, especially because then there was lots of different Roxanne, real Roxanne, Roxanne Shanta. Everyone just had a different Roxanne. And we were like, what? We actually thought there was some famous person that everyone was thinking about. Yeah, because all of a sudden you're getting a name that you've never heard before that everyone's talking about. But
yeah,
but I guess the fascinating thing is when you're talking about producing, getting into a studio, knowing how to use the turntables, knowing how to play instruments. How did that come about? And being six of you, who did what?
Well, as I'm thinking, the six of us, and it's crazy, but the six of us, and my brother B-Fine hated this, but it is how it is. We didn't even sign no contract. It was just a written rule, verbally and mentally, that the six of us, no matter who writes the song, it could be one person, it could be two people, it's always going to say written and produced by Full Force.
Wow.
And we're always going to split it six ways. So every record that we've ever done always said produced by Full Force. So Roxanne, Roxanne was the concept of my brother B-Fine, but produced by Full Force. I Wonder If I Take You Home by Lisa Lisa was concept of my brother Paul Anthony, produced by Full Force. I Want to Have Some Fun, Naughty Girls Need Love Too by Samantha Fox was produced and written by me and Baby Jerry, but produced and written by Full Force. All for One and One for All, you know. So and that and so whoever did the song, that person would spearhead that song in the studio and do the damn thing. You know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah. And then what would the rest of you, because that's very similar to what U2 do and even Coldplay. And you can see how those groups last because they were, you know, I used to love watching Behind the Music on VH1. And the one thing you hear is the one guy who writes all the songs makes 10 times the money and the rest of the band says, and they break up because the money comes in. But you had people like U2, Coldplay, doing written by Coldplay, written views. And that way there was that sense of, you know, we're all part of this and no one got left out. Back in those days, and that's what I said about the one thing that really stood out is the fact that even as three brothers and bringing in your cousins, that you guys were able to have that sense of, you know, we're doing this together. Because not many families, even the Jacksons, as much as I love them, it was Michael and his brothers and stuff, and that put a wedge in. So how did that sort of grounding, where did that come from, where, you know, the three of you and your cousins?
Well, I guess from our parents, and not just me and my brother's parents, but our cousins' parents as well. You know, our cousins, our families, our aunts and uncles, and my mother and father, our mother and father just put that sensibility of family and all for one and one for all, you know? And yeah, six of us. So, you know, when you split everything, it's not always that big of a pie, but that's how we kept it. And it was a sensibility of just family, you know what I mean? My brother Paul Anthony would say, hey man, my brother B could be at the studio and he could do the entire song from scratch. And Paul said he doesn't have to be there. All he knows is that when he gets to the studio, it's great. So if that makes him a better B-Fine, it makes him a better Paul Anthony altogether. So we just combine off of each other and we cheer for each other. So that's how we rocked it, you know?
So with Shy Shy, Jerry and Kurt, were they your dad's brother's kids, or how they related? Because you said the cousin.
Well, I would say like my mom's sisters and sister-in-law kids, and my dad's one brother as well. And then one of them, maybe Jerry's like more of a second cousin, but everybody's still a family affair. Okay. And the thing about it is my brother B-Fine, who didn't like singing, he used to like playing the drums. And he used to like playing the drums with our cousins because they were like a band. You had a keyboard, Baby Jerry was on keys, Shy on bass, Kurt on lead guitar, and B on drums. And he would be around the corner practicing, you know, doing more with them. And then I once saw them performing at junior high school, and I came back to Paul and said, "Yo, Paul, they're not that bad. Maybe we join the group as singers, as lead singers, and maybe take them to the next level." And Paul said, "Think so? Yeah." And I told my brother B, and he was so excited. He said, "What? For real, Lou? Y'all do that? For real?" He was so excited, man. And that's how we meld together as Full Force. I came up with the name. And let me tell you something. Our shows was incredible. You know, we used to perform, and then we used to do imitations, like as a Vegas act as well. We would do tribute to Chuck Berry, and Kurt would play on the guitar, Chuck Berry, and everything. Paul would imitate James Brown, or B would be Marvin Gaye. I remember imitating Sylvester and Luther at one time. I dress up as Sylvester and do Sylvester, then I do Luther Vandross. And we were just having a blast. That would just be a segment of the show. Then we wrote some original songs. And that's when Steve Salem came to see us perform in Brooklyn. And I said, "Steve, man, you should join us, man, because you got a good way of thinking." And that's when he talked about us writing and producing for others. And yeah, as no sooner than we finished writing and producing for Lisa Lisa and Cold Jam, which came right after Roxanne, that's when Full Force got a deal of his own. And I'll never forget, it was Sony Records, and it was a bidding war between Sony and Warner Brothers for Full Force. The guys that did, not as a group on its own, but the guys that did Roxanne and Lisa Lisa, they're the guys that's doing hip hop. And so Sony had this big meeting. We're now getting into hip hop, y'all. We're going to sign Full Force, who did these records, you know, but as a group. And they kind of jumped the gun because Warner Brothers wanted us also. And it was a bidding war, and then Sony went out, you know. But Record Deal is a group as well.
So, I mean, I think there's been a lot of stories, especially for the 90s acts, on us not knowing the industry and business and just signing. And then we had Prince talk about, well, you guys are taking my stuff. Back then, when you couldn't get a deal and you were writing and producing, did you get a sense of, well, if we do get it signed, what it's involved, what we own, and making sure that the terms are as good for us as possible? Were you aware of that part?
Not really. You know, my mother, bless her soul, she's the one that told us to look into publishing because we didn't know.
Wow.
You know, and that's what we started looking into, publishing and everything like that. You know, we signed with Zomba, who was great to us. And that's when we started knowing that, yo, writing and producing is kind of nice, even more than just being a damn group and performing. So that was, I mean, man, we wrote and produced for so many people, but that was our calling card. Even though we was a group of our own, Full Force Era group, but the writing and producing, and still to this day, and we still are able to collect checks, phenomenal, you know, phenomenal.
So, and so your mom got you onto that because that's, you, as I said, that is the golden goose. I mean, most people would tell you that. Yeah, most people now know that you're owning your own publishing, but and stuff. But back then, you were just doing it for the fun. You just thought performing, not realizing that if you write and own your own stuff, that's where things, because no one tells you anything.
Right. Right.
But then on the record side, if there's a bidding war, I would have thought then it's like, okay, so what makes you go to Sony over Warner Brothers? Is it that they're saying, we'll give you more points, we'll give you more ownership?
And we'll give you more control that you could do your thing. So that mattered a lot to us, you know? And it was phenomenal the way it happened. I mean, I'm not going to say who the exec was, but what happened is that Sony had a meeting, and it was the urban department, and they had a full-fledged meeting with the urban department and the pop department, and they announced ahead of this, they jumped the gun. They said, yes, we're going to sign Full Force. The guys did so-and-so. But then when they came back to us, I'm like, we didn't say we're going to sign with you guys yet. You know, they just wanted to sign us to a single deal, like for one song deal at first. And we said, we didn't say we was going to sign y'all yet, you know, we told that to the black department. So we didn't say that. So now they were scrambling because they made this big announcement, you know, with everybody there. And it's like, you got to do full. So what happened is that, man, he's such a nice guy. So what happened is that, A&R exec came to our home, Full Force's home, where we rehearsed at as well. And there he was saying, guys, you got to sign with Columbia Records, man. You got to sign with Columbia. You got to. I mean, I'm telling you, because it was that it better happen, because they wanted to save face, the black department, because they already made this big ass announcement. And now you don't really got Full Force, the guys that did UTFO and Lisa. So what happened is he said, guys, you really got to. And they did up the ante, Columbia, but then he said, guys, come on, please, please. I'll even get on my knees, man. And he got on his knees. We didn't ask him to. I'm like, get up, man. You don't have to get on your knees. Right in the living room, he got on his knees, guys, please, please. I was like, wow, I couldn't believe it. But he got on his knees, but we signed with Columbia anyway, not because he got on his knees, but because they offered us something really great as Full Force the group. And we never looked back. That's when we came out. Our first single was Alice, I Want You Just For Me, which was huge for us, top 10 in the UK.
And
other parts of the countries, because that was sometimes one of the first times merging hip hop and R&B kind of together, you know. So
yeah, so when you guys were you've agreed to sign, and it was this around 84 86, or when did you come out with Alice?
85 Yeah. So 84 was Lisa, Wonder If I Take You Home, and Roxanne, Roxanne. And then 85 was us.
Yeah. No, I was gonna come to the producing stuff because I know about Jasmine Guy and ex-girlfriend mm-hmm. stuff. So I was gonna come to that separately. But I wanted to know what was the happening in the landscape in that 85 when you guys were coming out. To my knowledge, there was Gap Band, but I don't know if they were around. Who were on the scenes that you were looking at and saying, okay, we can, that were, I won't say competition, because, but more so the groups that were out around that time.
I would say, yeah, Gap Band and Lakeside, and, well, Lakeside was late 70s, but Gap Band was out. There was a lot of, we didn't really look at the acts as competition, but at the same time, when we were coming out with Alice, I Want You Just For Me, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis just won the Grammy for Producers of the Year. And I'll never forget it. They did an article on Billboard Magazine. I'm pretty sure you could Google it. And after they did the interview, they say, right now, have you ever heard of Alice, I Want You Just For Me? Incredible record. Right now, Full Force is our favorite group. Now Terry Lewis and Jimmy Jam saying that, I'm like, wow. They're our favorite group right about now. And because of the song Alice, you know, even Prince. It was like Minneapolis loved Alice. So even Prince loved Alice. And I'll never forget. We was at an MTV party. And there's me and my brother sitting at a table. And then all of a sudden, Prince walks in with Ananda Lewis from MTV. He walks in with her. And as he walks in with her, and they was going to the... to another section, and me and my boss are sitting at a table, Prince takes his hand and he plants it right on my brother's shoulder, like saying, hey, how you doing? And Paul looked up and he said, oh, it's Prince. And then Prince bent down to the both of us and said, hey guys, Alice, I Want You Just For Me, phenomenal song. And then he got up to start to walk back. And my brother Paul said, hey, can you take a picture? And he said, and we didn't take a picture, but he gave us a compliment on Alice, I Want You Just For Me, Prince. And just the acceptance when he put his hand on my brother's shoulder and then he bent down and told us that, something that I'll never forget in my life. So at that time, it was people like that. I think the time... but we didn't look at competition. We were just happy to be there. Yeah. We were just so happy to be a part of it and seeing our dream come true. You know, we're like, wow, I can't believe this has happened to us, you know?
But because when I think about it, the parts, the elements of the track that do bring that Minneapolis sound, that the time and Jimmy and Terry. So I could see how they could say that this sounds a little like us, but very different. Who were you guys, who were your, sort of, I won't say role models, but who were the people that you looked up to as producers?
We looked up to a lot of people. I mean, it was a kaleidoscope of music people, from James Brown to Sly and the Family Stone. One of my brother's favorite vocalists was Gladys Knight. And
talking about your influences, the people that
So our influences definitely was James Brown, Sly and the Family Stone for sure. My brother loved the vocal stylings of Gladys Knight. My favorite R&B group, my favorite group of all time, group period, from the second grade to now, is the Legacy of the Temptations. Okay. My favorite, you know, the way they did their styling, in and out, singing harmonies, incredible. Jimi Hendrix, because we love the rock era as well. So it was a kaleidoscope of so many people. So yeah, of course we love Prince and the Minneapolis sound. It was so dope, you know. Yeah. But we always like mixed in with a lot about things as well, you know, something different.
And you mentioned that encounter you had with Prince. But were there others who gave you that kind of props? Because as I say, you guys were somewhat different in your image and the style.
Yeah, well, Mr. Brown, you know, Mr. Brown, he, you know, James Brown, I mean, you know, he's like, I'll never forget the first time we met him before we worked with him. You know, he was another one that loved Alice, I Want You Just For Me. And that's why we ended up doing a whole James Brown album. But he was like, when he first met us, he was so confident. He said, "All right, gentlemen, I love you like my sons. I love you like you're my sons, you know. And I'll do this for you. And I think we're going to have a good time. We're going to do a great record. And I really like what you guys doing." And we said, "Thank you, Mr. Brown." We didn't understand what the hell he said, but we're like, "Thank you, Mr. Brown." he gave us props. And I'm like, "That's James Brown. He knows us." And, you know, working with him, man, a dream come true. Nobody puts us in awe, but working with Mr. Brown, you put us in a little awe, you know?
Yeah, no, can you talk about that? Because I've watched a lot, I've seen a lot of his documentaries about, you know, he had his own record label, private jets, he had his radio stations. I mean, he was on, you know, I think no one could really understand the kind of influence and what he had achieved and stuff. But, you know, a living legend like that, and is, you know, but he hadn't had much since, I think it was the Rocky, Living in America. So he hadn't,
Living in America. Yeah,
there wasn't much happening. So the idea of you working with him, who brokered that
it came from Scotty Brothers, the record company that Mr. Brown was part of at the time, and where he did Living in America on, and it was that company. I'm sorry. No, I had to similar. So what happens, they contacted me and they said, "Yeah, we would love you guys to work with James Brown on his entire album." Because they wanted him to get back to the R&B roots. Living in America was a big hit, but not really on the black side, you know what I mean? But it was still a big hit, you know, yeah. Top 10. I think he won a Grammy for that, his first one. So once I got that call, I went back to the guys. I said, "Yo, they want us to produce James Brown." Everybody went crazy. I remember Shasha jumping into my arms, and it was ridiculous. It was like somebody hit the number, the lottery. And I was like, "We're going to work with James Brown." So we were so excited, and we was in a little awe. So then people are saying, "Oh, he's mean. He's mean in the studio, man. He's a mean guy, blah, 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 blah." Because we didn't know what to expect. So once people start giving us their rumors, I said, "Let me call somebody that worked with him and give us the lowdown." And it was Dan Hartman, because Dan Hartman was the producer that produced Living in America.
Oh, okay.
But Dan Hartman was also an artist himself, that he would do songs like Relight My Fire and Instant Replay. That was Dan Hartman, a disco guy. And so I called him up and I said, "Mr. Hartman, Dan, I mean, we're getting ready to work with James Brown. I mean, could you give us some tips? What do we do? We heard he's mean. What do we do to work with James Brown?" He said, "Well, you damn sure don't call him James. You call him Mr. Brown." And we called him Mr. Brown throughout the whole time we was working with him, which was like 2 months. And he prepped us what to do, what to say, what not to say, whatever. And this was the time that Mr. Brown was in trouble with the law. And, you know, he's going through his own personal thing.
Yeah.
So we was in and out working with him as he's going through all of that stuff. I mean, it was so crazy that, you know, every time we saw Eddie Murphy somewhere, Eddie Murphy would say, "Oh, man, Full Force, it's your fault that James Brown is just going off his rocker, man. Full Force to say James Brown go off his rocker." Oh, my God. But working with Mr. Brown was indeed a treat. And we're just proud that his last two top 10 records in his career was a song that we wrote, both songs that we produced called I'm Real, which went to number 2 on the Billboard charts, and then Static, yeah, which went number 5 on the Billboard charts. So working with him was incredible, you know? Incredible.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I was still in high school in Nigeria when I'm Real comes out, and it was like a hip hop sort of, it was a big track, you know, because normally I think James Brown was my grandfather's kind of stuff, but to be able to listen to something that he brought out, apart from the Rocky stuff, but this was really current and stuff. But in the studio, because he's had his own record label, he put out, what was he, Did he allow you guys to take control of the session, or was he say, this time I'm going to do it, and you just have to say yes, sir? And or what was it like?
He let us, he gave us total respect. He let us do our thing with him. We showed him this, showed him that. Sometimes we'd be in the studio with him going over the lyrics. You know, sometimes certain things he might not want to say, like we had a lyric where we say, I'm so real and I'm so deaf. But he didn't want to say that. He said, from what I, because, you know, deaf, we meant D-E-F, deaf.
Yeah, yeah.
But he said to us, well, first of all, I'm not going to say that because where I come from, deaf means hard of hearing. I'm not hard of hearing. I'm not hard of hearing. So we said, okay, Mr. Brown, we'll change that. So we changed it because we're supposed to be, I'm so bad and I'm so deaf. But he didn't want to say it. So we had him say, I'm so bad and I'm so real. And then in the back, we went, so deaf. This is my world. All you copycats out there, get off of my tip. I'm James Brown with force. Ain't taking no lip. And that song was a statement song because at that time, I mean, come on, everybody was sampling James Brown left and right. And Mr. Brown, he didn't mind the rappers doing it, but he hated that he never got paid anything. They put his voice on records and sample his bass loops and drum beats, and they didn't do another. So when we came out with that song, it was a statement. I'm so real. You know, we got when we opened up the video coming out of Copycat Studios, and we're like, this is the place that everybody's stealing from James Brown. James Brown, yeah, Copycat Studios. And you know, we had in there, it says, James Brown said, you better take my voice off your records, huh, till I'm paid in full. You know, you say you learned from me, stone to the bone. Then you take my arms and my legs and try to use it for your own. So we had lyrics there that James Brown wasn't playing. It wasn't until after that record, then the copyright laws started to be enforced to protect not only Mr. Brown, but George Clinton, Paul Mitt, Funkadelic, because the rappers were swiping stuff left and right. And listen, Questlove, he was a good friend of ours. I remember he said, man, it's so crazy because when you guys were working with James Brown, you guys was using the same method that all these rappers was using James Brown. I said, yeah, but the difference is we're using it on James Brown. So if we sample James Brown for James Brown is getting that money as well. So yeah. That's what we did, you know? Yeah.
But I mean, because I remember reading, this is, you know, during the 90s and the 80s, that I think Big Payback was probably one of the most sampled track in R&B. But I wasn't aware that he wasn't getting paid. I mean, I thought after this record and they changed the laws, was he able to get backdated pay? Was he able to go after? Because
yeah, I don't know about backdated pay, but after that he was getting paid. He might have got some backdated paid.
Yeah,
but his name started appearing on those records as a songwriter as well. I mean, you know, so because before he never did and he never got any money. And that's why we made a song called I'm Real. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been, if he was getting paid, there's no way we'd say that lyric, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you better take your voice off my records till I'm paid in full, you know. So.
Yeah. So the you know, after you work with him, I mean, and you're in the video, for you guys, your parents, because I'm sure they would have been listening to James Brown. What was their thoughts? Did they get to meet him?
My father was in the studio with us, and he met Mr. Brown. Mr. Brown called my father Papa Force. that was his nickname for him. So it was great. My mother spoke to Mr. Brown on the phone and met him during when we did the video for I'm Real. So yeah, man, they was living their lives through us as well. So I mean, working with Mr. Brown was great. When he started dancing in the recording booth, when we did a song called Time to Get Busy, I'm like, yo, look at Mr. Brown. He's dancing to our joint. What the hell? crazy.
So crazy. I mean, and that's, you know, that's truly amazing to actually to work, because, you know, people talk about working with Michael Jackson and Stevie and stuff, and but they'll all look up to James Brown and say, look, you know, he was the first and the original, and Michael always gives him props. But when you go from working with the Godfather to your godchild in Lisa. Now, oh, as I said, you know, there isn't any 80s party that if you said, what's let's talk our top 28 tracks in the 80s. You know, I Wonder If I Take You Home will always be, it's, you know, one of the biggest tracks ever made. And I remember as a kid hearing the track and it's like, oh, that's Full Force produced Lisa Nisa and Cult Jam. The thing is that you have a group of six producing a group of four. It just felt like, oh, a lot of people in that.
A group of three. And you know what?
Okay, let's do three. Okay, sorry.
And you better believe that you're right. It was a lot of people. And we didn't care. We didn't give a shit, because at that time, we noticed, besides Terry and Jimmy, because they even dressed a certain way and they had a persona about them.
Yeah, yeah.
Producers and songwriters never really used to get their props. You know, they never got their props, but we made sure we got our props. A lot of times, even in records we produced, we'd be like how Alfred Hitchcock used to be appearing cameos in his movies. We'd jump in there, Full Force, Get Busy one time, just in other songs. But Lisa was three people. So it was Lisa and the two guys from Cult Jam. But yet, Full Force was doing all the music. And we was doing all the background vocals with Lisa. You know, the guys from Cult Jam didn't sing no background vocals. We did that. In videos, they lip sync our vocals. But I said, for this first album, we're going to get our props, because this is when Take You Home was going to explode. And we felt it. So I said, so for this record, guys, it is not going to be called Lisa and Cult Jam. The artist's name will be called Lisa and Cult Jam with Full Force. Okay. And that's how I Wonder If I Take You Home was. That's how Can You Feel the Beat was. That's how All Cried Out was. Lisa and Cult Jam with Full Force. There's a method to our madness. So people would always have Full Force glued with Lisa and Cult Jam. And that's how we wanted it, you know, so people remember that legacy as well.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, as I said, we knew yourselves associated with that big track. But I guess I wanted to back, if you guys couldn't get a record deal, how were you able to get a deal for Lisa and Cult Jam? And what was the whole, how did that come about?
And we got a deal for UTFO as well. I mean, I go figure. But that's what Steve Stell was like, yeah, you just can't get a deal for yourself. So produce people. So when we produce Roxanne, it just so happened we went to this rap label, it was unknown rap label called Select Records. Steve Stell took us there. And they took a chance on us, you know. Who was to know that Roxanne would be so huge? And then the rest of their other songs as well. And then Lisa and Cult Jam, my brother B5 wrote the song, and he sang he did the reference vocals, the horrible reference vocals, but he did it. And the track was crazy from the jump. And Lisa just did what she was told. We auditioned girls. My brother B5 was adamant that it had to be a Spanish girl because, you know, there was no Spanish girls happening back then at the time, doing hip-hop, R&B, pop, and dance all rolled into one. You know, the only thing they had at that time going was Menudo. That's about it. Yeah, but Spanish people didn't have nobody else. B said, no, we want to gotta be Latino, because they got the same style as black folk. They got the same love as black folk, the same look. We got to make it Latino because there's no Latino girls. And that's what we did. We filled that void. You know, and Lisa was scared during the audition. You know, she's like, man, going in there and these six big black guys. I mean, But she was fine. You know what I mean? The thing about it is the songs that she was singing, because she looked the part. And we're like, oh, please thank God. I hope she could sing even a little bit. And she looked the part. She was really cute, sexy. You know, some of the world famous bosoms in music and dance music. And that's why people say, so is that why you call her Lisa? That's not the reason. But, no. But it was just a great thing. The thing about it, when she was singing songs, she was singing original songs that Mike from Code Jam wrote during the audition, and the song sounded horrible, which made Lisa sound horrible. So before she left, we just knew she was going to get it. And then Paul said, well, Lisa, before you go, could you sing us something that maybe is familiar, more familiar, you know, even if it's a cover song, familiar? And she sang an a cappella. She sang "For Your Eyes Only" by Sheena Easton. Hmm. And that was all she wrote. After that, she got the part, and the rest is history.
Now, I think there are two things that I wanted to go on with that is, by the time you'd finished working with UTFO and you'd gotten the deal, were you more versed onto understanding the business side of the music industry? And so are they signing to, do you form a Full Force record label and you're signing them onto you and managing, you know, owning the masters and then getting a distribution? Or what was the setup when you started with, say, Lisa and Cold Jam?
Yeah, well, they were signed to a production deal.
But with Full Force Production.
I know people frown on that now, but at that time, Lisa was signed to a production deal and we were the production deal, and it was still on Columbia Records. That way, Columbia Records couldn't take control away from us because Lisa was signed to a production deal. Yeah. So we have certain things to say. We got to say, like the song All Cried Out, which was a big ballad. You know, Lisa had a love interest in the video, and me and my brother Paul sang the male vocal parts. But the record company is like, listen, you guys could be in the video, but what about if you guys were silhouettes? Like, silhouettes? No. But if we didn't have a production deal, there'd be no way we could get that leverage. And we said, no, you guys got to get creative. And they got creative in the video. They had the love interest. I think it was a Spanish dude. And when me and Paul sang our parts, they showed the guy's face. His thoughts was us singing. But at that time, I know we... Not only was Lisa signed to our production company, but yeah, we co-managed her as well, along with Steve Salem. So we had all of that as well as that.
So when you guys signed her to your, you got the production deal, you weren't able to, Sony didn't say, well, can we also be on this so we can release through our production deal as Full Force? Or they said, now we just want what you bring us? Or
No. After Lisa, then Full Force. And that's why I think it was a method to our madness to call that first album Lisa and Cold Jam with Full Force, because it became so huge that, shit, we better sign Full Force too. What the hell? That would be so dumb if we don't. Yeah. And we did it. I mean, the album cover was ready before the music was. They was really rushing us to do the album because the song came out overseas and it was on an imported record, which was with various other songs like Malcolm McLaren's Buffalo Gal, but it was only
Buffalo Gals,
it was on there as a compilation, but our song was the new kids on the block type new group thing, and that emerged out of all the songs. That song emerged huge, and wow, for us it was great. The rest was history.
The thing that really stands out is that you guys didn't go for what I would have assumed and got, you know, an R&B black singer to sing it and just stay in a sort of R&B lane. But by going with Lisa, it wasn't more so just because she's Latino, but she sort of crossed the divides, because they're very much, she could have been right in the middle. She could saddle the black community, but also the pop community because of how she looks. Was that ever in your mind, you know, when you guys thought, let's get her instead of getting a black girl to sing?
Yeah, I don't think that was in our mind. The only thing that was in our mind, it was so organic that my brother B just wanted a Spanish girl. He wasn't thinking about, hey, it'll cross over. He just wanted a Spanish girl to do the dream because nobody's ever done it before. Lisa was before Shakira, Gloria Estefan, yeah. Exposé. She was before everybody, all the Spanish people. And my brother just wanted that to be a first. So she was definitely the first in that situation, you know?
I mean, sure. The video with you know, hair covering one eye. I mean, as I said, as a kid, it would just, you know, the beats was one thing, the subject matter of the song. I mean, so as I said, in high school, it was like, the biggest thing out there. The programming, the drumming, it was, I don't think anyone, I can't, who else was doing that? I mean, did anyone realize, say, wow,
It
you
was,
guys.
yeah, it was early on. People started getting into the drum machine, and so my brother Beatfine, Kurt, they worked on it together, and then Baby Jerry with the keep, don't, don't, but man, and they still play that song to this day in clubs. It's so. I saw. Listen, they played it when President Obama at the inauguration party, and there's him and his wife dancing to our song and mouthing the words. What a moment that was,
I mean, when
So.
you look back at it, I mean, it's hard. In the moment, did you when it was written, did you guys think, wow, we've got something here? Did you ever, did anyone, and as I said, I talked to Melvin Riley Jr., I've talked to Timmy Gatlin, I asked you get them, I said, when you guys are writing these songs, do you
You
know
said you
that?
spoke, wait, you said you spoke to who? Melvin Riley or Teddy Riley?
Oh, Melvin Riley Jr. and
Melvin Riley from Ready for
Ready,
the World?
Ready for the World.
Okay.
I've interviewed him, Timmy Gatlin, Donald Jones. When I talk to singer-songwriters, I always say to them, to ask them, when you're writing the track and you finish it, do you look and say, yeah, this is going to be a hit, or do you just hope for the best? What was it like, especially with that track? Because that is, I mean, as I said, it's in anyone's top 20 80s track. I mean, it's the most recognized, one of the most recognized. Did you guys know when you finished it, like, wow, this is something, or was it just?
We knew it was something. We just didn't know it was like going to be this huge. It's just like with Roxanne, Roxanne. We didn't know it was going to be the way it did, and that was the thing. From Roxanne to I Wonder If I Take You Home. What a 1-2 punch, and then Alice after that. But we didn't know. We just had confidence in ourselves. It's like trying to make it in the business. We didn't know. We didn't know when we would be successful. But we knew we would be successful. We just didn't know when, and it turned out to be like this, which is incredible,
When you look back at because I wanted to before I get to the writing process, but when you look back with all the songs that you've done, is there one that stands out? You say, you know what, this is the song that's, this song is my, as a, even at the time, even if you didn't think of it, but the fact that it's, is any particular song you'd look back and say, yeah, it's, we're this is our proudest one.
That's hard.
I know they're all your babies, you love them all and stuff, but
That's hard, but some that stands out, it can be like, a Lisa joint, I wrote a number one record called Thanks for My Child for Cheryl Pepsi Riley, and it was proud to see that go number one. I'm like, wow, I wrote that by myself. Wow. So those are some old, and I gotta say, of course, when we did the Naughty Girl, Samantha Fox, the records we did with her, like Naughty Girls Need Love Too, which was top 10 record, and I Want to Have Some Fun, which I think was the first commercial house record, really, to be on the charts. And working with her was just great because Samantha was just great fun. And those songs was big records for us with her when we flew out to England to work with her on that. So that was our first time there. So those things stand out. Of course, James Brown and Patti LaBelle. I mean, we got so much moments. The Backstreet Boys, which was a great to work with them. They weren't even known. They weren't even known in the United States at the time. They're like, I think you'd be great to work with Backstreet Boys. They're not known in the United States, but we're working on their album now, and they're going to be huge. When I went back, and Baby Jerry said, "Lou, I got an idea for the Backstreet Boys," and then Jerry started singing. But my love is all I have to give. Without you, I don't think I can live. Da, 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 da. I said, Jerry, that's a fucking smash. And I kissed him on his cheek and he punched me. And the rest is history. Ooh! Now, splitting up money for that song and for that album, It was fantastic. Worldwide.
I mean, you guys did something really unique in those early days working with, and I think a lot of artists are doing that now in Korea. They're going to work with the K-pop groups because they're selling records and stuff. But back in those days, I mean, the group like Backstreet Boys, I would say that even though, and by this time I'm living in LA when they came out, and, you know, and I actually got into Backstreet Boys. I mean, they were cool. I think even if you're into R&B, you could still say, yeah, the Backstreet Boys aren't too bad, because, you know, they had some good melodies, they had some good tracks, and they weren't trying to be, it wasn't New Kids on the Block who at the time seemed like they were competing with New Edition. They were different from our R&B groups, and they were separate, but they were accessible. Even as a black person, I took their music and enjoyed it and stuff. And maybe it's because you guys worked with them that you kind of gave them a road that we could take it without feeling like we're selling out and stuff. What was it?
When we worked with them, and then from them led us to work with Justin Timberlake and NSYNC and Britney and LFO as well, and like it was a time where we was just working with, we were like, Full Force love white people.
They were going diamond all the time, so yeah.
We had diamond plaques on our walls, so we was working with that and just having a ball. So working with the Backstreet Boys, we caught everybody off guard. Like the R&B people, they were like, "Yo, man, you know who's producing the white teeny bopper groups? Full Force." Everybody was so shocked, you know? But we were like the chocolate in the milk. We were the only black producers that worked with NSYNC at the time. And it was just a great thing to do that. And I remember when we did another song with the Backstreet Boys called My Heart Stays With You, but All I Have to Give was the biggest one we've done with them. And I'll never forget, with Clive Calder from Zomba and Jive Records, they said to us, okay, now when you go, Clive called it.
He's English, yeah.
Right. Now, when you go to England, when you go to Florida with the Backstreet Boys, let the youngest member, Nick Carter, let him sing the whole song, because the girls love him. They love him. Let him do it, because he's once again, they weren't known in the United States yet.
Okay.
But Clive calls, like, they known all over the world. Like, they love Nick. I said, okay, Clive, we'll do that. But I knew we weren't going to do that. I wasn't going to let Nick lead the whole song just because the girls like him the most. I harnessed back to my inspiration and love for the Temptations. Oh, if you know the Temptations, they had different lead singers. And sometimes in one song, they each sing in parts.
Yeah.
So I wanted to bring that to the Backstreet Boys. But then when I got there, I found that the only three of them really sang leads. That was Nick Carter, AJ McLean, and Brian Littrell.
Oh yeah, Brian, the main vocal, yeah.
Right. They were the lead singers. So I said, okay, for this song, the way we arranged it, I see one person sing in the beginning, then the other person sing another like lead vocal part. I don't know. But I'll be there to make you smile. I don't have a fancy car. You are walking 1,000 miles. Then the other guy, which would have been, first was Nick, then I had Brian. I don't care if he buys you nice things. Does his gifts come from the heart? Then Brian, and then the hook. But my love is all I. So see, so I got the two. So the next time around, I'm like, okay, I know I'm going to get AJ, but Howie D, I noticed he never sang any leads in any of their songs or any of their videos, but those three. So I brought Howie to the, I spoke to AJ. I said, yo, AJ, and Brian Littrell, I said, yo, how comes Howie don't sing any leads in any of y'all songs? No, he's just background, man. He's just background vocals. That's it. He's just a background singer, just background vocals, you know, no leads for him. I'm like, really? Yeah. You don't do that. I'm like, okay.
So then I took Howie to the side and I said, Howie, how can you not sing any leads? I mean, you got a nice voice. I mean, how can you not sing leads? He's like, I don't know. I said, you don't know? Well, guess what, brother? This is going to be your first lead vocal on this song that Full Force is producing. What? He was so stunned. I said, yeah, it's going to be your first one, man. And that's how it's going to be. And Howie, to this day, this song was done, came out in 1996, 1997. Yeah. Me and Howie still like this to this day. He's forever indebted to me for giving him a shot. And he's such a great guy. And we still, that turned his musical life around. Because then after that, he was able to do lead vocals on the Backstreet Boys songs and album. And I'll never forget when he was in the studio doing his part for the first time in their career, because they've been working together for so long. And as he's singing, AJ comes in there like, whoa, Howie's in there. Because I didn't tell the guys I was going to give Howie a vocal. And AJ's there, and Howie's doing his lead vocal part. My brother Paul Anthony, Baby Jerry, is vocal coaching him. But I arrange who sings what and who sings where. And then after he says to Howie, he said, hey, Howie. Wow, man. Yo, man, now you got a personality.
That's so funny.
Wow. And he did it. And let me tell you, man, to see him in the video with his heart, he came out there. That meant a lot to me. That was big for me because I love giving people chances. And I'll never forget on MTV, whenever they do it, the countdown. And that was produced by Full Force. I'm like, man, this song is in the countdown all the time, MTV. And then when the Backstreet Boys came to MTV, I forgot the show that it was. Carson Daly hosted it. But they came to perform live. And they sang All I Have to Give. They're sitting on stools. And right when, and you see all the white girls singing our song, like, wow, they're singing our song. And then Howie, at the end of the song, Howie says, shout out to Full Force and Bowlegged Lou. I got that on video. I was so cool of him, you know. And it got so crazy that when we would go to their concerts, I'm like, this is ridiculous. And I remember one time me and Paul, my brother Paul Anthony from Full Force, we was in the lobby and as the Backstreet Boys was getting ready to come on stage, because we was in the lobby basically, and the Backstreet Boys was getting ready, come stage, you hear everybody screaming. My brother Paul goes, hey Lou, come on, we're getting ready to go on. I'm like, we're getting ready to go on. You mean the Backstreet Boys?
Hilarious. I mean, did he get any? Did the other guys say, well, what's Howie singing? Or were they supportive? Because I know you, Brian, you said that they were saying, no, he doesn't sing background. But when you put him on, what was the take?
They was very supportive. Why? Because we were supportive. And it was our song. And we said, this is how it's going to go. And I just had fun. All right, Nick, you open up. Just like the company said. Brian, second. And then I did a little middle part. You know, over you. I even had Kev do a little bass part in there, and they supported him. They supported him all the way. So it was just a great moment and exciting, and just, I mean, how he invited me to his house for dinner. I'm there at dinner with the family, and then I said, Howie, is this the first time you've had a black guy over for dinner? And he started laughing, and then he said, yeah. And it's so funny. And then when he got married, like years later, I was there at his wedding and I sang at his wedding and I did a poem dedicated to them. And I'm like, yeah, man, I'll never forget when Howie, because I gave him a lead vocal to do All I Have to Give, he invited me to dinner. And I was like, hi, my first black guy there. And he said, yeah. And I'm like, and here I am at this wedding. And just like the dinner, I'm the only black guy here at this wedding. Hilarious. It was funny.
Were you surprised how big they blew up?
Oh, my God. I mean, remember, the record company already told me there was huge overseas. So then, yeah, when we did our homework, I'm like, wow, they are huge. But working with them in Orlando, Florida, they were not known at all. I remember Brian Littrell says, yeah, man, we can't walk the streets overseas. In England, Australia, Germany, Holland, no way, we can't walk the streets. But in their own hometown, Orlando, the States, they could walk anywhere they want because nobody knew them. And he said, that's what I really want, man. I want to be able to be known here in my own hometown. I'll never forget that. Right. And they blew up huge in the United States. And I was like, wow. And we're part of that. You know? So yeah. Incredible.
Yeah, because what happens here in the UK, back in those days, we had pop idols and then we had Take That. So the boy bands, the white boy bands were big. And so it was quite easy to bring them in. They hadn't yet crossed because after New Kids in the Block, there was a low and it became more the R&B stuff. And the 90s was such a great time for black music, but also for, I won't call NSYNC pop because it was sort of a crossover kind of a blend of music because you had a lot of really good, in fact, I actually listened to a lot of the white NSYNC, Backstreet Boys, Britney, a lot of the Florida, Orlando, Florida sort of imports and stuff, and as well as
myself. You know, so crazy. It was so crazy because there we were, like the only black people, the only black producers at that time in the studio working with Backstreet Boys, NSYNC, because they were signed to the same company. And with Justin Timberlake, who used to emulate and do Usher dances because he loved black music so much. I mean, he did the beatbox, everything. And they were big fans of House Party, the movie that the three of us appeared in as the bullies, Taysom Kidd and Play. They loved that. And we would be like the only blacks there at the compound because that's where we'd go to work with them. And as we're the only black people there at the compound working with them, whenever another black person like walked in there, we would huddle amongst ourselves. Who the hell is that?
Was it Jerry Wright? Is it Jeffrey Wright? I can't remember. Their manager.
Johnny Wright.
Johnny Wright. Was he?
Johnny Wright was there because he was just a manager, but Johnny Wright managed both of them actually.
Oh, yes.
That's been a conflict of interest where he had to give up one and he gave up the Backstreet Boys and he was with. And he's still Justin Timberlake's manager to this day. But he loved us. He loved our song. We had a single called Temporary Love Thing that he loved like crazy. But we were there working with these guys, man, and it was incredible. I was like, wow, man, here we are working with the whole boy band situation, which was part of that. And then 18-year-old Britney Spears comes to our Brooklyn studio and we're working with her. You know, the best vocals that Britney Spears ever had, and you can get this on YouTube, there's a song called Love the Hurt Away. You listen to that song, which was in the beginning, because we was working with it from the beginning. You listen to that song, and there's no Britney Spears vocals that can match that. And that, once again, that's what we bring out of artists. And my brother Paul Anthony is such a great vocal producer. And it's just an incredible song, incredible her, you know. But we celebrated her 18th birthday there, and we saw when she and Justin Timberlake was boyfriend and girlfriend. And, it was crazy.
But back in those days, could you tell Britney was going to be the megastar that she became?
I didn't know, man, because back then the record company was telling us to do like a remake of the Jets, one of the Jets song. I forgot what it was. I'm like, that's where y'all wanted to be? Because when we first heard the first demo of her, she sounded, I know it's going to be, you're not going to expect this, but I swear she sounded like a young Toni Braxton, Britney Spears. I know you like, get out of it, but it's true. They changed her vocal after a while to fit the whole pop thing, but she was rocking and rolling. And like I said, you go listen to the song Love the Hurt Away. It's on YouTube. You hear Britney sing the way that, you know, she's supposed to sing, but I didn't know she was going to be huge, huge like she ended up becoming either. I don't know. None of the boy band groups would go. Because I'm like, well, New Kids on the Block, I think that's it. I didn't know about
it. Yeah.
And who would have known? But we were there very happy.
What about Justin Tim? Because you mentioned Justin, because I know he's the big one now. But when you were working with NSYNC, did he stand out from day one that he was?
Yes, indeed. Him and Jay-Z Chazes were the lead singers, basically. Yeah. Chris was the high falsetto. Lance was like low note, and who was the other one? It was Jay-Z, Justin, Chris with the high,
Lance. Oh, and Joey. I forget Joey. And Joey was in there. And they were great to work with also. Almost to the point where the Backstreet Boys had a meeting with us and they didn't want us to produce no records on NSYNC. And we're like, you know, but this is our livelihood and the record company is, yeah, but no, we don't. But you know, it is what it is. But Justin definitely stood out. He was the one doing the human beatbox. And it's so funny. They all love black music, but Justin, him? I mean, he grew up with Al Green. Their parents loving Al Green. And he respected black music so much that we did it's so funny. And he stood out with his vocals. I mean, he was incredible. You know, Jay-Z too, but Justin, he was from another world. But the crazy thing about it, just to show you his love for black music and how he wanted to be accepted by black music, which he ended up being accepted at the time. And because I remember he even won the Soul Train Award for best R&B vocalist. How crazy is that? I knew that was his dream come true. Because I'll never forget when we did an article for Vibe magazine, which is an urban magazine. It's a black magazine.
Yeah, Vibe. Yeah.
And we was like the cover story about, wow, Full Force producing these pop acts. Britney, Justin Timberlake, Backstreet Boys, LFO. And in the article, Baby Jerry mentions this one thing about Justin because of Black Magazine. He says, yeah, man, you walk to the farm, you walk to the compound, and there you see this white kid named Justin Timberlake doing the human beatbox and singing Brian McKnight songs. He loved black music. And then, now, this is a big article, but just that sentence alone, when we went back to the compound, Justin is like, where's Jerry? Jerry, thank you. Oh, what you said in the magazine. Oh, my God, thank you. I'm like, just that? I mean, it's a whole big article. Just, yeah, but Jerry, what you said. Oh, Jerry. That was like his acceptance, being in a black magazine and Jerry saying that to him, you know? So he always respected black music. And yeah, he was a dope vocalist, you know, still to this day. And it was great working with NSYNC too. They were a little bit more, Backstreet Boys was great. Justin and NSYNC was great too. Both of them, the same thing. But there was a little bit more hyper energy with NSYNC than Backstreet. But they both was great unto themselves, you know?
Well, was there conflict then? Because if you worked with both, did you then see Backstreet Boys saying, we can't work with you guys anymore because... What was the case?
They just told us don't work with NSYNC anymore. we couldn't. You know, we ended up still working with both of them. You know?
Okay.
But it was funny. But it's funny that, yeah, it was like sort of a thing. And Backstreet Boys felt the way because they paved the way, you know. And they kind of felt the way about NSYNC being managed, of course, by Johnny as well. And then now here they are taking some of the same producers. So Backstreet Boys was feeling a way at the time, you know.
Yeah, and it was strange because they might have been five white guys on both sides, but they did look different. One looked a little bit, they just looked like, they looked like, well, I wouldn't say Jodeci and Boyz II Men, but you could tell that they were two different.
Definitely two different people. It was almost like Backstreet Boys might have been a little older,
yeah.
And NSYNC was more like a little younger and like free for all kind of, you know.
Yeah. But I guess
they both was exceptional, great groups to work with, and it was just an incredible moment for us back then. I mean, man, it was just incredible because then we started working with all these other. I mean, you go to YouTube and you find a group called Take Five. We did stuff with them. Innocence, we did stuff with them. All the unknown white groups, poppy groups that was coming out of that compound, they were throwing at us and we was working with them. I was like, man, this is crazy. And then I'll never forget with Clive Davis, you know, Clive Davis, the legendary Clive Davis.
The Godfather.
We could never get a meeting with him, like never. Until when? Until we produced the damn Backstreet Boys and we had a big smash. Then we met with Clive Davis for the first time. It was almost like meeting the wizard.
Yeah.
Oz, like, now you can meet. Now you can meet Clive Davis. And we walked in there and we sat down and talked to Clive Davis. That's how we got to work with LFO, who was signed at Arista at the time.
Okay.
And hilarious though. But yeah, man, it was just a great time for us back then.
I mean, there was one other act that I wanted to talk about, which was Jasmine Guy. A lot of us would have remembered her from A Different World, and I remember Timmy Gatlin talking about doing some work with her on her debut album. And I think it was really strange because we knew she was an amazing comic on A Different World, but to know that she also had this ability to sing and be almost like a ballet dancer kind of a stuff, I don't know if her character in A Different World was such a strong one that it kind of made her singing career, it made us double take, like not take it as serious. What was your thoughts? Because I've seen a video you posted with her, almost like you guys were best friends, but what were your thoughts about how her acting affected or influenced her singing career?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I didn't think, because the song she did with us was a top 20 song. It was this, you know, huge for her, especially on the West Coast. Forget about it. They played it like constantly. It was called Try Me. And is that the video you saw that I made talking about Try Me?
Yeah, and the one that you had where, yeah, the one that she sang it on a senior and yeah, I saw the video you made.
And then me and her was in the studio together.
Yeah, in the studio, yeah. It was amazing. I could feel.
Yeah, first of all, I love Jasmine Guy still to this day. Through the ups and the downs, I love her. And who knows? People probably, I think they gave her respect when they saw her perform that song. It was that her first video. And when she performed it on the Arsenio Hall show with the dancing, people were shocked. They were like, wow. People that didn't know that she came from a musical theater background. So if the acting kind of messed it up, who knows? I remember Jamie Foxx, you know, he couldn't get a deal at one time. He was like, yeah, Lou, man. I remember him leaving me a message when we was producing all these pop groups, and he said, hey, Lou, man, I got a bunch of songs that I wrote. You could have them, man, you know, to do, you know, for the pop groups that you're doing. I remember getting that voicemail, and he sounded sad, you know, but then, you know, he struck gold. But with Jasmine Guy, I don't know if that hindered anything. I don't know, but I know we had a great time working with her, as you saw in that video. She's just special, you know.
I think there's, before getting to where you guys are now musically, I guess it's the, you know, the big thing was, you know, House Party is a film that, you know, I was fortunate to be in the generation that, you know, to get to watch it. It probably had one of the best, you know, soundtracks that we've had in a long time. It was an amazing soundtrack. But the fact that you guys were, you know, were cast to play the bullies there, and you had a lot of rappers and actors all around, did the acting part come natural for you guys, or was it, did you see it as a way of promoting the Full Force brand, or what was your thoughts when you guys accepted the offer?
Did it come natural? It definitely came natural with us, because ever since we were little kids, me and my brothers, we was doing plays in the house. Mm-hmm. I would write little plays, because in college I majored in theater, but back then we were little. Oh. I would write little plays, and the three of us would just act them out in front of company, in front of my mother and my father, and we do these plays that I would be writing for them. So as little kids, we always had that chemistry with each other. And in the script for House Party, we were written, because first of all, my two brothers appeared in the movie Crush Groove, where they played two bullies that was beating up Blair Underwood, who is an actor, and he portrayed Russell Simmons in it. And they had two scenes where my brothers beat them up, but they had such a presence, and they had the jerry curls and the muscle shirts. Nobody was doing that. So when it came to House Party, Reggie Hudlin, who wrote and directed House Party, he literally had in the script, the original script, he used Full Force as descriptions. So he said, kid in play, or whoever had the role at the time, because Jazzy Jeff from Fresh Prince was offered it first. But he said, kid in play is accosted by three bullies with bowling ball muscles
and droopy Jerry curls. Somebody like Full Force. That was literally in the script as a description. So a mutual friend of ours named Robert Ford, who's close with Reggie, said, Reggie, why don't you just get Full Force? And Reggie's like, yeah, I didn't even think of it. He's like, you're describing them, get them, see if they can act like what you want them to do. And he called my brother Paul. The three of us went down and we did like a sort of like an audition. And we just did a monologue that we just made up. And they already saw we had the chemistry to act. And bam, they casted us. And I'll never forget that table read. All of us at the table read, reading the script. Us, Martin Lawrence, Kid and Play, Tisha Campbell, George Clinton, who played the old school DJ. Mm. I mean, it was incredible. And we read it. But then when I went back to the hotel with my brothers, I said, guys, our parts in this script, it's not all that good to me. We're like bullies without personalities. So I said, let me change a couple of things. And then let's show it to the Hudlin brothers. If they like what I change it to, then great. If they don't like it, we'll keep it the way it is. And I remember my brother Beefine was supposed to be the character of Peavy, and I was supposed to be the character named Zilla. My brother Paul was our leader, and he was the name Stab. His name was Stab. And I told my brother B, I said, B, let me be Peavy. You be Zilla, because I'm smaller than you and my brother, you and Paul. And I'm going to talk like this throughout the whole movie. He said, what? I'm going to talk like this throughout the whole movie. What are you going to talk like that for? I said, I don't know. I just want to talk this whole movie. So I just developed a character. I'll never forget Tisha Campbell calling me after seeing the movie, after not seeing it in like 20, 25 years. Lou, what made you come up with that character? And not only did I come up with the character, but my brothers got tired of me because even during lunch breaks, I was still staying character. I was staying in character until we did a, you know, it's a wrap. Then I would come into Lou. So they hated me for that. Will you shut up? Talk like yourself. We're eating lunch, damn it. but what happened is that I came up with a part. I'm gonna kick your freaking ass. And another part, I smell pussy. So those two things are kind of iconic lines, especially in the Black community. Everybody knows it. When they see me, sometimes they don't even ask me to say it because I know they want me to say it. I said, you better do this or else I'm going to kick your freaking ass. I mean, I say freaking now, but it's really in a movie. I'm going to kick your fucking ass. And my inspiration for that character was, I would say, like three different people, but it was like part Jerry Lewis, part Curly from the Three Stooges. Yeah. And I would say Joe Pesci. Oh. Joe Pesci did Lethal Weapon Part 2 with Mel Gibson.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And he's kind of talking like this. But he had this hook, and he kept going, okay.
I remember that.
That was his hook. So I'm like, I'm going to make up a hook and it might stick. And boy, did it more than stick. I mean, Jesus Christ, to this day, I still say it and I go, huh, story of my life. And I remember we showed the Hudlin brothers the one scene we changed. And when we did all of our thing. The Hudlin brothers said, keep it. And we kept it. I was so excited because after they told us to keep it, what did I do? Or what did we do? We went to every scene that we was in that movie and we changed it. So everything you see in that movie, Full Force wrote. We should have got damn writing credit, but we didn't.
But you did have I'm trying to get the song. Ain't My Type of Hype. Yeah, as I said, it was an amazing soundtrack, you know, Big Bob, yes. and everyone on it. And I guess the music part, because we focused on your production, we had your first album and stuff, but the music industry sort of shifted and changed, even the whole New Jack Swing sort of changed in the mid-90s, where it was sort of kind of R&B or hip-hop soul and stuff. did you, I know you guys started producing sort of Backstreet Boys and stuff, which is a lot more money in the publishing, but did you just feel musically coming out of yourselves that there wasn't a lane for you anymore?
Yeah, man, it was hard, man. Things were changing up. Our outlet was the Backstreet Boys stuff. That was our solace, you know. Other than that, it was kind of rough. You know what I mean? Music was just changing up, switching up, and stuff was getting hard. Once we did the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC, we was feeling better about ourselves. But the music changed and definitely put a damper on a lot of things. But you know, we would never change anything for the world. I mean, the run we have, and we're still producing and writing stuff, was incredible. You know, I go back, I'm like, man, we work with so many people. And, you know, you take yourself for granted. I take ourselves for granted. I'm like, man, we built some bricks in this place called R&B and hip hop, you know?
Yeah.
Because we got to do our thing and got to work with people like we, you know, I got a platinum plaque for Rihanna upstairs and Lil' Kim and Black Eyed Peas. We co-wrote Don't Funk With My Heart.
Oh.
Selena, we were the last American producers to work with Selena. Ashanti, 3LW, I mean, B.B. King, Bob Dylan. I mean, so many people, you know. The Weather Girls. I'm like, what are we doing? We're working with these people, you know. But, you know, it's just a blessing, you know, just a blessing.
The industry has changed quite a bit now, but what are you guys, are you still producing? Because R&B music has a very, you know, it's hard. It's really hard.
Yeah, we still produce. I mean, listen, we're still just doing it. It's definitely a different animal now, for sure. But we still produce and stuff like that. And then when this COVID is up, we still go out and perform. In fact, we're supposed to do a Lisa and Coach Jam Full Force reunion. Wow. You know, where we're going to do new music and, you know, hit the road as well, you know, once COVID is up. So we're going to do that because at that lane, the urban lane for shows, and Charlie Wilson was still performing.
Yeah.
I mean, every Black performer was still doing shows all over the country, all over the world, you know, so.
Yeah. So the one thing we should expect is you guys, new music and a tour with Lisa and Colt Jam.
Yeah. Yeah, man. That's what we're going to do. And we're excited about that. And, you know, we can't wait. We're going to be putting that together now. It's just in the talks now, but it's definitely going to happen. You know, it's definitely going to happen.
Now, the one thing I always ask all my guests before they leave is that if you were stuck in an elevator and you had to, and you're going to be there a couple of hours, and they say, look, we can put a movie on for you while we try and get you out, what movie would you request to watch?
So easy to say, House Party.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go for it. I was going to say Monster Ball and just run that scene over and over when Halle Berry's making love to
Billy Bob Thornton. Yeah.
Billy Bob Thornton. What did she say? I forgot what she kept saying, but man, I love that. She won an Oscar for that.
Yeah, she
make
did.
Make me feel good. And Billy Bob Thornton, well, I'm going to make me feel good too.
Yeah, I think he directed it.
I definitely have House Party in there. Because, you know, because House Party, that movie, still to this day, it still plays good.
Yeah.
It don't feel like it's old. It doesn't play like it's past its prime. It still plays good.
Yeah. And it doesn't encapsulate the feeling of the 90s. They're about to put the movie on, but they say, okay, we'll play a song before the movie starts. What song would you request?
My favorite song of all time, The Greatest Love of All.
And not
a lot of people don't know this. Not the Whitney Houston version.
Not the Whitney Houston version.
The original version. And you're probably saying to yourself, I thought the Whitney Houston was the original version. No, it's not. The original version that I adhere to, that I worship, that I sing. Every time I sing that song, I've been singing that song since college, almost to the point that every college production, and I come out to sing, you know, you have people, oh, Lou, I wonder what song you're going to sing now. Because I always sing this song.
Wow.
The Greatest Love of All by George Benson. That's the original. Have you ever heard of George Benson?
Yeah, no, George Benson. Yeah.
Yeah, the jazz great, the jazz guitarist great. He's just great. He's singing. You know, he had a hit of his own called This Masquerade and lots of hits records, but he did the original version of The Greatest Love of All. And his version is like my favorite. And if you go on YouTube, go Greatest Love of All, George Benson, you'll see. George Benson actually did that song in the movie The Greatest with Muhammad Ali. Not the one that Will Smith did, but the one that Muhammad Ali actually did. Did you know Muhammad Ali did a movie that he acted in and it was called The Greatest? Did you know that?
No.
The first movie that was called The Greatest was starring Muhammad Ali. Google that. You'll see. And George Benson sang the lead track of that, which was called The Greatest Love of All. You know, loved it. Loved that song to this day.
Okay. Yeah. Now I'll check them out. Two good things. I guess I can't stop but without asking about the health of your brother, Paul Anthony, and then, but also yourself.
Yeah. My brother, I mean, first of all, I'm going to talk about his last, because this is such a great field concern, but I'm dealing right now with a disease called retinitis pigmentosa, which they call RP. And it deals with the eyes. It has no cure right now, and it leads to blindness. But I just try to stay proactive in everything I do. Right now, I don't have any peripheral vision. I just got straight vision, because the way this is actually, it's almost like tunnel vision until it robs your sight with this disease. But I think in next week or so, I'll be starting a 2-week treatment with Dr. Rosenfarb, who's an alternative doctor, and he deals with Chinese medicine. And I'm doing this new thing called HBOT, which is the hyperbaric oxygen therapy, which is great for your eyes, and it stalls any progression of any more sight loss, you know, until they find a cure for this, because I want to see forever. My brother, on the other hand, my brother Paul Anthony, he was dealing with mantle cell lymphoma cancer, which turned into leukemia, and he was a fighting champion. We still call him the cancer champion, because he was always positive about it. Don't feel sorry for me. Don't do nothing. And Paul Anthony's, you know, the guy that played Stab in House Party, the leader. And when he was really fighting for his life, when things was looking bleak, that's when the doctors say, okay, you got to do a bone marrow stem cell transplant. Me and my brother B-Fine, earlier we had tested to see if we would be even a match for my brother if he had to do something like that. And I remember my brother B saying, I think I'm going to be the match because me and Paul look more alike. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, who cares? Whoever looks alike, I don't know. Whoever's a match, that's what we want. We don't want him waiting on a long list for a match, you know. And I was his 100% match. Wow. I was his 100% match. He was fighting for his life. They said, okay, you, Lou, you're going to have to inject yourself twice a day for 2 weeks, and you're going to harvest your stem cells. So I would be at home twice a day taking Neupogen shots, which harvest my stem cells within myself twice a day for 2 weeks, just for my brother, because he was in the hospital with his immune system going lower and lower and getting weaker and weaker. So when it came time to transform my stuff into his, I was there at the hospital, and they were telling me, they said, listen, Mr. George, that's my last name, says, Mr. George, you have to sign this waiver, you have to sign this paperwork that we're about to do the stem cell transplant, but you have to sign. But first, let me tell you what can happen to you. It's a possibility that your spleen could get ruptured and you could bleed to death. There's a possibility that, you know, you'll have excruciating headaches, you know, and that there's a possibility that you could lose your life while doing this. There's a possibility, they told me a bunch of other possibilities. And then he said, okay, do you still want to go through with this? Do you want to sign? Do you still want to go through with this? And I said, of course I do. He's my brother. I would die for my brothers. Of course I want to still go through it. I mean, who wouldn't? And then they looked at me and the doctor said, you'd be surprised, Mr. George.
Which means that, yeah, they've had cases where after they tell them this hard, tell them what to do this and do that, and they got to sign off, some siblings change their minds. I said, you're trying to tell me they don't change their minds and don't go through with it, knowing the sibling could pass? He said, yeah, because they'd be so scared out of their minds. I'm like, wow, well, not me. I'm rocking in this. So I did it. So when I went in to stay at the hospital, they said, now, Mr. George, if we don't get, your brother needs 6 million stem cells. Mm. If we don't get enough from you for him, we're going to take a catheter to your chest and try to draw it out as much as we can to get to 6 million. Because they thought maybe I might have been too old and I wouldn't have enough. That's what they felt. But I fooled them all, including myself. I ended up giving my brother 9 million stem cells, and I became a conduit from God to help save my brother's life with 9 million stem cells. So you can call him bow-legged Paul right now. So he's 8-year cancer free. So wow. So it was a great to do that, and I celebrate it every year. You know. So
well, I did see the video that you did when it was. I think it was celebrating the 8-year, and I think that's, you know, that brotherly love. I named my youngest. I said if I was going to have another son, I was going to name him Andrew, because I loved how Andrew looked after Peter. Like, you know, you need to come see Jesus. You need to always. First thing he did was look out for his brother, and I actually, because I did that, I can see how my youngest son really loves his older brother and stuff. And,
wow.
And when I saw how you would talk about your brothers, it just brings something in me that, wow, this is not, it's not very common. You know, we all love our brothers, but you guys seem to really show a love, which is probably a benchmark for siblings to understand that, you know what, you may have differences, but it's you guys, you know, and that's the one thing that, as I said, it always rings out. And the fact that you guys have been able to work as a partnership in the one of the hardest businesses on earth, the music industry, and not fall out over stuff like that is a testament to what you guys do show is love. And I really, really admire that. And it'll probably give me stuff to look forward to with my younger brothers as well.
Nice, man. That's fantastic. Appreciate this interview, and I want to tell people out there as well, you can find our handles on social media. You can find Full Force on Facebook, Instagram, it's Full Force World. I'm on Instagram as The Bowlegged One, the number one, and then I'm also on Facebook as Lou George. But what I want to say to your viewers out there also is, like, listen, even if you have a dream to succeed in music, and not just in music, but you lawyer, doctor, whatever you want to succeed in and do, you got to always believe in yourself. I mean, it's so easy to get down on yourself. Like with Full Force, like I said earlier, we knew he would succeed. We just didn't know when, because we believed in ourselves. Many times we'd get together and talk about, this is how our video is going to look. When we do this video and that video, and one of these days we are going to get a gold record. And, you know, to see those dreams manifest because you believed in yourself. And people out there, if you want to be a doctor, a lawyer, this or that, stay positive and keep on keeping on. If a door is shut in your face, you knock that shit down and you go to another door. You know, if you believe in yourself, your dream will come true to do anything that you can, anything. You know,
thanks for watching. Please remember to subscribe to the channel, but most importantly, to press the notification bell so that you can be notified when we do have a new interview, loads to come. But thanks a lot for watching. You know.